Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This most recent flood in the region has left us with so much to think about. It's going to take time to first meet immediate needs and then to bring everybody onto the same page where the future is concerned. To begin that conversation, we're joined by Dr. Bill Hainberg, state geologist and director of the Kentucky Geological Survey, as well as a research professor in earth and environmental sciences at UK. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Hainberg.
Well, thank you for having me.
10 inches of rain in a very short period of time, a virtual deluge. As one who studies these things, what do you make of the most recent flash flooding in eastern Kentucky?
Well, a lot of things. It's clearly extraordinary. I think it's one of those things that's hard to comprehend what that must be like. I have worked on a landslide in Nepal where they got about 14 inches of rain in 24 hours. And you know, you try to imagine what that must be like, just it never ending. So one, it's an extraordinary occurrence. And as we've seen, the consequences of that have been very tragic in terms of human lives and property destruction, and it's going to take years for those communities to recover. And of course, the loss of human life is completely tragic. And it's one of those things you look at, and I think it's hard to comprehend the magnitude of what went on there.
Well, this question might be more meteorological than geological, but do you see connections between climate change and the severity of the flooding that we're now experiencing?
Yeah, and it's always hard because eastern Kentucky, as we know, has always been a flood-prone area. It's mountainous, the valleys are narrow, the slopes are steep, and when it rains, the water runs off fairly quickly, and the problem is exacerbated because there's not much flat ground in eastern Kentucky. So we can't say a flooding would have never occurred if there hadn't been climate change. But what we do know and are very confident of is that these large extreme events are very likely, if we continue on the current path, going to become more and more common. And, you know, things that may have been 500-year floods may now become 100-year floods, and 100-year floods may become 10-year floods or 20-year floods. So there is a connection, not just necessarily the severity of one event, because people can say, oh, we might have had a storm this big 100 years ago, but I think the issue is going to be that we'll be having them more often, and also as areas grow, and the value of the infrastructure increases, if you look at the damage from those, just the cost to repair them, is going to continue going up. And it actually does tie into a lot of the work that we do here with the Geological Survey, because we're interested, for example, and have been working, we're just wrapping up a FEMA-funded study of landslide hazards and risks in the Big Sandy Area Development District, and are just getting started on one in the Kentucky River Area Development District. So from our perspective, we're looking at things and saying, well, okay, we have all these models of how landslides occur and where they occur, but those are all based on what's happened up to this point. So now how do we move forward and take into account what we anticipate is going to occur because of climate change and incorporate those into our models and try to understand what the landslide hazards and risks might be in 2050 or 2100.
The Army Corps of Engineers just did a flood mitigation plan for Johnson County. Are you aware of any plans by the Corps to expand that to the region, or do you think that is needed?
I don't know specifically about what the Corps of Engineers is doing. I can tell you that we do have a statewide hazard mitigation plan that was last issued in 2018, and work is underway for sort of a five-year revision of that. And we at the Kentucky Geological Survey are contributing to the geologic aspects of that, things like landslides and sinkholes and coal mine subsidence and earthquake hazards. So I know that statewide plan is underway, but you know that will be sort of a broad synoptic view of the entire state, and it won't focus specifically on any of the counties that have been affected or even any of the down to the ADD level.
You mentioned this earlier, and we know that flatland in the mountain region is at a premium. It's precious land. Are Are some populated areas of eastern Kentucky located in floodplains?
Yeah, many of them are. Floodplain actually has a variable definition because it depends on the severity of flood. So we might talk about the 10-year floodplain or the 100-year floodplain or the 500-year floodplain. So whether or not you're in the floodplain depends on the magnitude of the flood. And then, as I mentioned earlier, that as climate changes and we start receiving more precipitation in Kentucky, the models tell us it's going to become hotter and wetter if things continue on the current path without any significant emissions reductions. What we can expect is the 100-year floodplain may not, the way it's defined now statistically, that there's essentially a 1% chance in any given year that that area will flood, and that might increase, might double or triple. So the 100-year floodplain might become the 50-year floodplain or the 30-year floodplain.
What do you think we should learn from this most recent event? Are there infrastructure solutions and protections that might be put in place?
There are. One of the issues has always been, first, that it's difficult terrain, and two, there's not a lot of room to implement options. And in risk assessment and risk management, people often go through a hierarchy. And the first thing will be to try to avoid the problem if you can. And then you go through various things, how you mitigate it and use maybe administrative measures or engineering measures. And then the absolute last one is personal protective equipment. So you can say, well, the first thing might be to just follow the advice that sometimes people give and say, well, just don't build your house in a floodplain. But if you look at a place like Eastern Kentucky, where else is there really? There aren't a lot of different areas where you can build. So I think that's one of the problems in Eastern Kentucky is that if you start looking for other areas, there aren't many options to say if you wanted to move a town. If you look at what happened to Beattyville, not this time, but the last time around when we had those terrible floods, the whole town is situated in a bad location with respect to flooding, but really you can't pick up a town and move it because there's nowhere to go. And you could start talking about engineering measures, flow diversion. We could build bridges, for example, with more clearance that would be less susceptible to flooding. But that immediately becomes very, very expensive. And you're talking probably billions of dollars to start implementing the kinds of measures you would need to do to try to adapt our infrastructure to the things we're seeing now, let alone moving into the future. And you may have seen somewhere along the line, the American Society of Civil Engineers every so often puts out an infrastructure report card for the country. And the entire country, so it's not just Kentucky, the entire country usually gets pretty dismal grades. There'll be maybe a C at best and lots of D's and F's just because as an entire country, our infrastructure is in pretty sad shape.
We just reported on that rating for dams in Kentucky. We have about 1,000 of them, and I think they got a D-, so it's not great. As a strictly a practical matter, can this be seen as kind of a double-barreled situation in that the extraction of fossil fuels through surface mining, through mountaintop removal, even deep mining, seems to be contributing to this problem, while the product that is a result of that mining also is contributing? It's an elephant in the room. How do you see that from a geological perspective, or just as one who studies this kind of situation?
Yeah, I think you're right. The product and we also historically have had a lot of oil and gas production in Eastern Kentucky. So it's not just coal mining. And of course, if you're going to be drilling oil and gas wells, you build roads and drilling pads and things like that. But it becomes complicated really quickly because we have basically a 200-year history of natural resource extraction throughout Appalachia, going back to iron furnaces in the early part of the 19th century and logging for those, logging for railroad ties, coal mining, oil and gas. And then you start asking, well, okay, was coal mining specifically responsible for it? And it can be hard to say because it depends how old the mine was, what reclamation standards were in place, when the mine was there, were they done correctly? Even if it's an operating mine, you can design a mine to very high standards, and you could say, well, in theory, they might even mitigate the effects of flooding, but what happens if you design a mine for, the 500-year rainstorm, and then you get the 1,000-year rainstorm? We also know, in fact, I had a summer intern working with me over the past 2 months, and I had to take a break away. She's downstairs in an intern research showcase giving a presentation. We're looking at some of the mountaintop removal embankments that have started to fail by landsliding. But it's a complicated question because you have to consider all those factors. And also, we don't have a lot of before data for before and after data. So we know they do make a tremendous, leave a tremendous footprint on the landscape. And it leaves a lot of barren ground. It generates runoff. We know there have been a lot of studies done about the health effects of mountaintop removal mining and downstream water quality, downstream ecological diversity. But it's hard to pinpoint and say this wouldn't have occurred if it weren't for the mining. But it without question has left really a major footprint. There's a study I often refer people to done by a nonprofit group called Sky Truth, and they went back and looked at the footprint of surface mining in the Appalachians going back to satellite images from 1976. So that would include evidence of mining a little bit before 1976. And they calculated that about 7% of central Appalachia of the surface area had been impacted by surface mining. And they, by way of comparison, they said, well, that's 18% larger than the area of the state of Delaware. So that's a lot of bare ground, a lot of ground that will never be returned to its natural functioning as watersheds, never will be able to really be naturally revegetated. So it on what sort of conceptually you say it how can it not have an impact? If you look at published studies, some show that there is an increase in downstream flooding, and some seem to show maybe there isn't so much. So it becomes a little bit uncertain there. But when you look at the magnitude, it's when you think 7% of Appalachians, I calculated the other day when somebody asked, is an area, it's about 2,300 square miles, or it's an area that would be a square 48 miles on a side if you put it all together. So that's a big area.
It certainly is, and we will be very interested in the findings of that latest research you mentioned. So I'd like to check back with you when you're ready.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, please do.
All right, that's Dr. Bill Hainberg, state geologist and director of the Kentucky Geological Survey. He's also a research professor in earth and environmental sciences at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much, Dr. Hainberg.
You're very welcome.
It just come in all of a sudden. I mean, what's in minutes? It was minutes. Within 20 minutes, it was underwater almost over. Within an hour, everything was, you know.
What Dustin Moland experienced in South Jackson as inch after inch of rain poured down on saturated soil and into those rapidly rising streams has been repeated by people throughout the region. The storm and the flash floods that followed were sudden, intense, and overwhelming. Dr. Chris Barton joins us now from UK, where he is a professor in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment, to talk about the streams in eastern Kentucky and more on why the topography, geology, and mining in the mountain region have these streams so prone to flash flooding. Welcome, Dr. Barton.
Thanks, Tom.
So we just heard state geologist and fellow UK professor Bill Hainberg say that unless climate change is drastically reversed and soon, these large, extreme flooding events are likely to continue with more frequency. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective as one who studies this, who studies hydrology, the science of the movement of water in relation to land, do you share these concerns?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a perfect example of where, you know, the land uses like mining, the things that normally we're concerned about as far as the movement of water within a watershed, factors that control that are all out the window on this one. When you have a storm of this magnitude, these systems are just not able to handle that much water in that short of a period of time. And we have a lot of data from Robinson Forest, our UK's research force, where we've looked at the rainfall runoff response from storms over the last 50 years. And what we found was in that area, Robinson Forest happens to be in parts of Breathitt, Perry, and Knott County, right in the heart of where that storm was. And what you have in that area are a lot of what we call headwater watersheds, or the head of the holler, I guess is what a lot of the local people might call it. And these are small watersheds that are 100 to 200 acres in size. And you have hundreds of these feeding, you know, the sort of mid-sized streams that feed the Kentucky River. So Troublesome Creek, for instance, which had a lot of flooding and damage on it, is fed by hundreds of these little headwater streams. And through our research, we found that these little streams, when it rains and we have heavy rain events, about 60 to 70% of the water that comes into these systems moves out very quickly as stream flow. So rainwater coming in, moving out as a stream flow. And in these systems, you know, in an urban environment, we worry about things like impervious surfaces and stormwater management because of the water that's just moving across the landscape. Well, in these forested environments, we don't see overland flow of water. The water actually infiltrates once it moves through the canopy of the forest and infiltrates into the soil and moves subsurfacely to a series of ephemeral streams, which are streams that flow in response to rainfall. And those feed these streams, which subsequently feed other streams downstream. So this geology and this very steep topography make these systems very flashy, you know, as is. And when you have a rainfall event that's twice, you know, the magnitude of anything that we've seen at Robinson Forest over the last 50 years, you know that the consequences are going to be catastrophic.
So when you get those weather alerts, quite often we'll see flash flood watch, which means it's possible. But if you see a flash flood warning, that means head out of there. It's coming, correct?
Exactly, especially in that particular environment. And and like I said, I mean, you move to other parts of the Appalachian region and you don't have the particular geology or, you know, the steepness of that topography, and it's very bisected. So it's very, you know, it's almost like a V-shape, some of these watersheds. Very little floodplain, and the water moves out of there very, very quickly. So when we do have these large precipitation events, especially when you have high intensity, you know, high volumes of water, that's when they're most susceptible to flooding.
Chris, some people from outside of the region can be pretty much counted on during one of these events to criticize Eastern Kentuckians for choosing to live in floodplains. But what are they failing to understand about the reasoning for locating communities next to stream and riverbeds instead of up on higher ground?
In this particular area, really the only flat ground is in the floodplain. And there are some terraces, you know, along the side slopes of these hills. And you potentially could build on the, you know, some broad ridge tops, but the amount of money that it would take to put in roads to get to the top of the mountain, it would be much more than the value or the price of the homes. So it becomes an economic, you know, issue on, you can't afford really to build a road up to the top of the mountain to situate a house, but it's also a convenience thing of being able to be in the floodplain, where not only is the flatland, but that's where all of the roads and the electric infrastructure, and in some of these places where they do have public water sources, it's all right there in that floodplain.
Are there model remedies out there, model infrastructure that we could look to that could prevent these floodwaters from rushing into communities and homes along stream beds and taking into account the dynamics that you described earlier in hollers?
I think that's an evolving sort of technology, and you see it occurring a lot in areas that are experiencing ocean rise, and coastal areas are thinking about these sorts of solutions right now as far as elevated, you know, structures to put them up higher than the floodplain, or in the case of these coastal communities, higher than the rising seawater. But really the issue here, and you mentioned it when you started this interview, it's a bigger issue than a local solution. It's a national, it's a global solution that we need to be looking for, because with climate change and the heating of our atmosphere and these record temperatures that we're seeing, we're just getting a lot more water vapor in our atmosphere. And once that reaches saturation, it has to come down somewhere. And unfortunately, you know, this was the location that it ended up hitting. And so we really need to think what we can do to mitigate climate change. It's really the biggest solution that we need to be thinking about.
Are there consequences to mining that play into these floods and to the water systems that tend to flash flood?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that we really need to look at. There has been some scientific evidence that would suggest that these mine sites are potentially more flood prone because of the change in the land use, or going from a forested type of condition to a non-forested, generally hayland pasture or shrubland type of condition. You don't get as much evapotranspiration in those grasslands as you would in a forest. So that would suggest that you would have more water available for runoff. And then you link that with compacted soils that have much less of an infiltration capacity than a natural forest soil would. So those two things together would suggest that you're going to have a lot more likelihood of water runoff and movement, similar to what you would have in an urban environment on these mine lands, than you would in a natural forest. But, and here's where the issue that we really need to study is, once they do the mining, you have actually reduced that issue with the topography and created a more gently rolling landscape. So the water isn't moving nearly as fast through that landscape. And secondly, not on all mines, but some mines certainly put in a lot of engineered structures to actually control water movement. So things like sediment basins and retention ponds and drainage ditches. So it's a much more engineered landscape that certainly would produce more runoff, but it may be more adept to handling that. So we do have some hydrology equipment out on some mine lands in the area where the flooding occurred. I'm not sure if it's still there or not. I know that we've lost a lot of our equipment in the flood, especially some of that at Robinson Forest. But that's the sort of thing we'll be able to, if it's still there and we can retrieve the data, be able to examine and sort of answer these type of questions. Because, as you know, these are old questions that have been around for, you know, decades on what is the impact of mining on flooding in that sort of eastern Kentucky area where mining is prevalent.
Well, since this happened, I've seen several references, like on Facebook, for example, to the Pikeville cut-through. And, of course, that was an incredible feat of engineering and construction that I think second only to the Panama Canal, they say. But realistically, do you think we're talking about engineering on that scale to mitigate this flooding? Or should we even be thinking about tinkering with Mother Nature?
That's a great question. It seems a bit excessive, to be quite honest, to be tinkering with that way. If it's a matter of life or death, yes, we should be thinking about some of these engineered approaches. But again, I think it goes back to what is the cause of the problem and trying to address that directly. So we really need to be looking at solutions for reversing, you know, the climate change that we're seeing. And I think that's really the bigger solution here.
Well, what's your advice to people who live near these waterways in Appalachian Kentucky? Are there things that the individual can do to at least better prepare and to stay safe?
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely something that will likely come of this, is to have, you know, preparedness actions ready to be able to mobilize and move out of a system. You know, I know we have a system of, like you mentioned earlier, flash flood warning, flash flood watch, but maybe that needs to be taken more serious in these areas, similar to how we deal with tornado warnings in other areas. But I certainly think better preparedness action plans could be developed for this type of scenario, knowing that the likelihood that we're going to have more similar events like this is going to be higher going forward.
All right, that's Dr. Chris Barton, professor in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. Thank you so much, Chris.
All right.
Early on, when those floodwaters recently barreled through eastern Kentucky, we began hearing reports of people in hospice care, trapped in their beds as the muddy waters rose around them in their homes. Lindsay Kampfer with Bluegrass Care Navigators has been keeping in touch with caregivers in the region. She's here to share with us what she has heard, as well as to shed light on a state-administered program providing the health care people need as they age. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lindsay.
Thanks, Tom.
So first, if you would, tell us what you're hearing as you make contact with hospice caregivers in the flood areas.
You know, our service area in eastern Kentucky is fairly large, and we've had a lot of communication between our team members, our patients, and those loved ones that are providing care to them. We're hearing a lot of devastation. We're also hearing a lot of uplifting stories of community members banding together to help one another out. There hasn't been a single family in that area that hasn't been impacted, either themselves personally or from their loved ones, specifically for our hospice patients. Early on, we had great difficulty. The infrastructure and communication down there was wiped out from the flood, so it has been extremely challenging for us to connect and provide care by either reaching them telephonically or even for those in-person visits. You know, the roads have been washed out, so we have team members and family members that are using any means necessary, if that is use of boats or kayaks, to get out to roads and then to meet up with folks wherever they can to get the proper supplies and medications for their loved ones.
Well, I know that hospice care is very stressful for everybody. You all certainly do make it easier to endure. But one of the things that has struck me as I've read accounts coming out of the area is how in one situation after another, it was a terrible decision to make whether to stay or go, and whether to try to move the person who's in hospice care out into floodwaters. Just a terrible set of circumstances. Have you heard things like that?
We have. You know, what's unique about this situation is while eastern Kentucky has experienced flooding in the past, it's never been to this volume before. So this is really historic in that respect. Individuals down there have weathered floods before, but nothing to this magnitude. And as a result of that, I don't think anybody could predict or even fathom how extreme the outcomes were going to be. The other piece of it that I think made it really challenging for individuals is that the water level rose so quickly that there wasn't really a lot of time for people to process or to even begin the thought process of how do we logistically move our loved ones from their homes, or do we have the ability to do so?
Does this situation have you all thinking about the future and what might be done in these circumstances to help people get out of harm's way more quickly?
Absolutely. you know, emergency management is always part of healthcare. You're always trying to think through, trying to plan ahead. We're always looking at weather patterns so that when any type of severe weather is coming through, that we're helping caregivers and patients and other community members think through what needs to happen to ensure the safety and continuity of care of the folks that we serve. So it's definitely going to be an opportunity where we'll take a step back once our teams are safe and we have some distance between the flooding. Right now, we're just really focused on making sure basic care needs are met, but we will absolutely reevaluate and determine if there's any changes that need to happen from an organizational standpoint or even how we provide care.
In your role at Bluegrass Care Navigators, you're in charge of something called PACE, which stands for Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. And I believe it's the first in Kentucky, is that right? And what is PACE?
Yeah, you are right. So PACE stands for, as you mentioned, Programs of All-Inclusive Care of the Elderly, and it is a unique model of care in which Bluegrass Care Navigators serves as both the provider and the health insurer for individuals that qualify for PACE. The goal around PACE is to meet folks within our communities where they're at, and the focus is to try to allow them to age in place.
What kind of services do you provide?
So one of the really cool things about PACE and something that's really exciting is that it's holistic healthcare. And when I say holistic healthcare, it's really looking at healthcare disparities in addition to the traditional healthcare that we're most familiar with. Part of the PACE model of care also takes into account things such as transportation and food security, as well as housing or lodging, to ensure that somebody's well-being is being best accommodated.
Are these costs covered by Medicaid and/or Medicare?
PACE is reimbursed by both Medicare and Medicaid. It's a program that's supported by both the federal and state level. Individuals that qualify for PACE either need to have dual eligibility, meaning both Medicare or Medicaid, or they can also be recipients that just have Medicaid health as health insurance coverage. There's even an option for folks to pay privately, but under the PACE model of care, us as Bluegrass Care Navigators are financially responsible for ensuring somebody's health care needs. So what that means is that our individuals don't have any monthly deductibles.
Is the PACE program now open to enrollment, and how long does that process take?
It is. We are thrilled to share that as of August 1st, we have enrolled the very first PACE participant in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Enrollment takes a little bit. So unlike traditional healthcare, PACE is composed of 11 core interdisciplinary team members. And as part of that enrollment process, each one of those core team members has to meet with potential PACE participants and do initial evaluations. From that point, we have to submit information to the state as well as to CMS, where it is an agreement, essentially, that this individual not only qualifies for PACE, but is an appropriate candidate.
Lindsay Kampfer is Associate Vice President of PACE at Bluegrass Care Navigators. Thank you so much, Lindsay.
Thank you so much.
With us from Hazard are Jerry Roll, CEO of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and the Foundation's Chief Strategy Officer, Laura Smith. Jerry and Laura, thanks for taking a few minutes to bring us up to speed on what's going on.
Thanks for having us on.
Jerry, bring us up to date on your relief efforts. What is the Foundation providing?
Well, unfortunately, Tom, I would just say we're getting pretty good at disaster philanthropy. It feels like about the time we get into doing the real work of lifting up our region and getting things moving forward the way that we are and have been, there's another disaster. These 100-year floods are coming every year now. But what we're doing is we are collecting resources under the umbrella of Appalachian Crisis Aid, and we feel like our role is to really draw the attention of philanthropy and charitable giving to these relief efforts. There will be state funds, there will be federal designations, but we're going to need a lot of philanthropic support just to get people feeling human again and to help leverage all of that capital that we're going to need over time. This is going to take years.
And Laura, your perspective on this?
Similar to Jerry's, we are doing direct outreach right now. We have people right now canvassing in shelters as we speak, taking in information. But as Jerry said, this is years of recovery ahead of us. And not just recovery, but building new systems and new built infrastructure that can be resilient so that when natural disasters like this happen again, we're better prepared.
Businesses also have been hit so hard by this. Are you all helping in that area?
We certainly are. Our small businesses are the core and the anchor for all of our communities, and we've really pulled our small businesses together to think like a region, draw more attention to the region, make ourselves more of a destination. And now several of our downtowns are again underwater. So we have to respond to those small businesses.
And Jerry, the foundation, I understand, is partnering with the Community Farm Alliance to help family farmers who've been hit by this flooding. How will that assistance work?
Well, as Laura mentioned earlier, our goal is to get money into people's hands as quickly as we can. The money that we're able to raise with this level of devastation is not going to solve anybody's problems in and of itself. But our money is flexible. We can be nimble. We were here before this flood happened. We will be here when this flood is over. These are our friends, our neighbors, people we know. So we, as Laura said, just want to get out there, get some money in their hands, let them know we believe in them. We are going to be here for the long haul. Come to us. We will help as a community. We are going to work through this, figure out what each of us needs, and then seek the resources it's going to take to really make it work. I'm sure Laura might have something to add to that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as Jerry said, we have been doing consistent disaster philanthropy work since 2020 and COVID. And during that time, we've made grants to small businesses, to downtown projects to help downtowns maintain commerce and come back as a place of public life, and to small family farmers. That fund you mentioned with Community Farm Alliance, we have had farms completely devastated during this flood. You know, not just loss of crops, but loss of homes and equipment. So we're going to keep doing what we do, which is to move money directly to people, including small family farmers, including business owners, while also working on these larger pieces of funding and infrastructure to bring the whole community back.
Do you anticipate a need to adjust what you do to take into account an ongoing, unanticipated need created by this latest event in addition to preparing for what comes in the future?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I think one of the great things about the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is that it is filled with very smart and adaptive leaders. So we have been changing how we work and, like Jerry said, staying nimble and staying focused and flexible for many, many years. Every time we go through one of these crises, we are updating our policies. We're capturing learning. We're sitting down and taking the time to talk about what went well and what didn't. I don't think this type of community response is going to change. I think that we will always be doing an aspect of this work, but I think we're also looking at forward-facing solutions with our funding. So as an example, just this year before the flooding, Appalachian Impact Fund, which is a fund that the foundation holds, made some investments into our local Housing Development Alliance to purchase property and start building a subdivision that is up high on top of a mountain near the airport in Hazard. We're going to have to think about our development differently moving forward and where we build our homes, where we build our businesses. And the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky is definitely in that mix, thinking about things that involve resiliency, that involve new ideas and new ways of living and working here in the region.
What's the best way for us to keep current on what you all are doing and to contribute?
You can go straight to our website, appalachian.ky, and then do /flood. That has all of our updated information, a button to donate, and we will be updating that page weekly to let people know what we're doing and where the opportunities are. appalachianky.org is the URL, and you can go straight to that flood page from there.
That's Jerry Roll, CEO, and Laura Smith, Chief Strategy Officer at the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky in Hazard. The foundation is a WEKU sponsor. Coming up after the break, the exhausting nature of racism.
It's the enduring impact of racism's injury on your mind, body, emotions, and soul.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald Houses in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More information at www.togetherwesaveky.com. WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker. Provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
What is it like? What does it do to a person to be on the receiving end of racism? Dr. Candace Nicole Harguns, an associate professor and chair in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Kentucky, specializes in relationships and racial trauma. And she's Gerald Smith's guest for this latest in our series on racial justice and equality.
Good afternoon, Dr. Harguns, and welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you define racial trauma? And also, how did you become interested in this subject?
To begin with, the definition is to speak to the interest in it, because it's the enduring impact of racism's injury on your mind, body, emotions, and soul. And to be a Black girl growing up in a predominantly white neighborhood and going to predominantly white schools until I entered Spelman College, I was subject to so many racist stressors, but I didn't have the language for it. And so going through my PhD program after having attended Spelman College, I had the language and now knew what to call racism and how to understand its impact. But I was training to be a psychologist and learning all of these skills that helped with healing and coping, but none of them were being applied to the impact of racism. And so when I pursued the academic position at UK, I chose to use that as one of the ways that I would contribute.
So what have you learned from your research and teaching experience about the thoughts, feelings, and experiences of African Americans who experience racial trauma?
Well, I think sometimes people imagine that it's just hurt feelings when you experience a racist stressor. But the research demonstrates that the deleterious impact of racism has physiological consequences. So it impacts our physical health. When you see higher rates of high blood pressure and diabetes and reproductive health issues and all of these health markers, oftentimes in Black people and people with other racially marginalized identities, some of that can be attributed to living in systems or experiencing interpersonal racism. So it increases your cortisol and your heart rate, and it creates distressing thoughts. So it's not just the way we think, not just what we feel, but also those bodily or physiological impacts as well.
So what do you say to people who dismiss those psychological and physical signs of racial trauma?
I think some people are committed to dismissing them. And so even if I were to present them with a large evidence base or statistics or other data, for example, I conducted an experimental study where Black students were exposed to consensually a racist stressor. And then I measured their biomarkers, like I measured their heart rate and how their heart rate went up when they listened to this person say something racist. Even if I showed that type of evidence, some people are committed to the idea that we're just making it up. And that's because I think deep down, they understand that if they were to admit to the injury of racism, then they'd have to do something about it. And many people feel invested in the systems the way they are. And so they don't actually want to dismantle systems of racial oppression so that we can have more equity and care universally.
So have you found that Black people in Lexington and in Kentucky experience racial trauma differently from Black people in other regions of the country?
No, I haven't experienced it differently or heard differential reports. But what I have noticed, especially as you can imagine in 2020, where we experienced like a lot of attention into Kentucky around the murder of Breonna Taylor, that Black people here are as resistant and as engaged in dismantling these systems as other places. Sometimes folks imagine that because it's the South that people are complacent with racism, and I haven't found that to be true. I found that people are every day doing things that they can do at whatever their skill level is or whatever their area of expertise is to make sure that we have a more equitable world to leave to the people in our care, our children and our grandchildren and our nieces and nephews and, you know, our community at large. So I think that has been one of the most beautiful things about being in the Lexington community and bearing witness to the many ways that Black people here are engaged in our community and attempting to help each other, heal each other, and take good care of each other. So if I could, I'll share about the Neighborhood Healers Project. It's a project funded through SAMHSA that my colleagues and I launched in September of 2021. So we're coming up on the year anniversary, and we trained 20 Black community members, people who are already leading, pastors and hairstylists and first ladies and barbers and community activists in mental health first aid. And the resounding yes that we got when we made the invitation to them said a lot, because this is an 8-hour training and a year-long commitment to help impact the mental health promotion for Black people in Lexington. And we got a resounding yes. And to date, they have worked with over 1,000 people in our community. I couldn't do that as a psychologist alone. And so that type of community initiative, that type of collaboration, that's what I love seeing in Lexington.
So what kind of services does the Center for Racial Trauma provide when it comes to intervention and prevention?
So on the intervention side, we offer individual telehealth-based therapy. So all of the clinicians see the clients through telehealth. And then we also offer group therapy, or healing circles, as we called them. So we partnered with the Lexington Black Prosperity Initiative last year, and we hosted healing circles for 6 weeks with Black men and Black women, and then more recently, Black couples. And so in those experiences on the intervention side, we've seen people talk about how much more connected they feel to themselves, how much better they feel like they know the Lexington community, because some of the people were living in Lexington but not from Lexington, and how better improved their awareness of how racism has impacted their well-being is, and we gave them coping resources to help them take good care of themselves and each other. On the prevention side, we've hosted a number of cultivating an anti-racist mindset trainings or healing racial trauma trainings around the nation. So our intervention work is primarily focused in Kentucky. We see clients throughout the state of Kentucky, not just in Lexington, but our prevention work is nationwide and even international. And so we have worked with organizations like Paramount and worked with Penguin Random House and worked with university leaders and worked with nonprofit organizations to help them cultivate an anti-racist mindset amongst their staff so that they don't continue to perpetuate any harm in the communities that they work with.
What are some of the challenges you've encountered in doing this work?
Well, I think the main challenge is that when I do this work, people who are a part of it, they feel inspired. They feel enthusiastic, not shamed or blamed. So whether I'm working with white people or people of global majority, they feel encouraged and inspired. However, people who've never been in a training or who've not had the opportunity to see how I work or see how my team works have on occasion, not as often as, you know, some people have experienced, but have on occasion slandered or spread misinformation about the type of work that we do, taking pieces of the training that they found online and then reporting it in news outlets that are really not seeking to improve race relations in the world. And so I've experienced some of the backlash from that. That includes, like, you know, hate mail and threats and disrespectful language and media coverage.
So how then can we as a society cultivate then an anti-racist mindset?
Well, it begins with understanding what racism is. Many of us were socialized in educational systems where we didn't get a good definition. And so you had no idea it was racism when you were seeing it, even if you felt something wasn't right in your body. So establishing an understandable but very thorough definition of racism is where we begin. And then we start to think about all of the systems that intersect with racism that can continue to injure people, to harm people. And the commitments that we have to make include reading and learning from people of the global majority, people with racially marginalized identities. So listening to radio stations like this, or following people on social media, or listening to podcasts, reading books, reading academic texts that talk about the experience of racism and that give you the blueprint of what to do about it. Because for generations, people of color, people of the global majority have been talking about how to cultivate an anti-racist mindset. I'm not the first to do it, and I won't be the last. But it's really up to people who are interested to look for those resources using the library, using Google, and seeing who is talking about liberation, who is talking about anti-racism, and taking the time to read those books.
Is there anything that we can do to the younger generation, you know, those who are preteens or teens, to sort of reach them and kind of aid and guide them through dealing with racial trauma?
One thing I love about that generation is that their steps ahead of my generation and generations that even came before me, because they understand mental health as something that needs to be attended to, whereas most of us didn't hear about therapy. We didn't hear about that type of healing. And so now they know, if I'm struggling with something distressing, including racism, there are people I can talk to about that. And I should do that. And it's not shameful. And there's no stigma associated with it. So I really appreciate their openness and willingness to be proactive in their healing. And if they continue to do that, and if we continue to encourage them and support them, fund them in doing that, then I believe we're going to be in a good position.
Well, that's Dr. Candace Nicole Hargons, Associate Professor in the Counseling Psychology Department at the University of Kentucky and Director of the Center for Healing Racial Trauma, a Lexington-based organization. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
You can contact the Center for Healing Racial Trauma online at centerforhealingracialtrauma.com, also on Facebook and Instagram. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Spencer Shook, intern, Ella Fitzgerald-Dean, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can also find us on the WEKU app and on NPR One and the Google News app. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.